Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is India's ambitions. With me to discuss India's foreign policy outlook and view of the world is Manjari Chatterjee Miller. Manjari is Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council. She is also a Research Associate in the Contemporary South Asian Studies Program at Oxford University's School of Global and Area Studies. Manjari is most recently the author of Why Nations Rise, Narratives and the Path to Great Power. Manjari, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Jim. I'm delighted to be here.
Manjari, where I thought we could start out is by having you give us sort of a broad picture of how the world looks from Delhi. How does India see its interests? What threats and opportunities does it see? And what are its ambitions with its foreign policy?
That is a very broad picture. So I would say that India's perceptions have changed in the post-Cold War period, right? So particularly over the last decade, there has been a shift in how India perceives the world. A lot of that has to do with the rise of China, but a lot of that also has to do with the deepening partnership with the United States. So if I were, you know, Prime Minister Modi and I looked around, what do I see, right? I see Pakistan that is clearly an enemy that is out to destabilize India. I see Pakistan supporting a Taliban government precisely because it hopes that the Taliban will nurture terrorist camps and send jihadi groups into Kashmir and attack India's security. And I see this happening because it's asymmetrical warfare. Pakistan is considerably weaker than India, and this is one way in which it can destabilize India without outright war, just dancing on the brink of it. I also see China, and I see China, and I'm very bewildered by China because, we have not had good relationship with China since 1962, since the disastrous, or as the Indian government officials think of it, as the disastrous Indian border war, where India lost territory and lost the war very badly to China. I see a border that's in flux. I see Chinese military and infrastructure build up along that border. And I don't comprehend why they do what they do when it comes to Galwan Valley or Doklam. I see as China being assertive, but I don't quite understand the reasons why. I think that's just how China is. I see that territory and I see it as integral for India's identity. The territory itself is not valuable in any way, but it is integral to India's historical conception of itself. I see the United States withdrawing from Afghanistan, which worries me in terms of, you know, what kind of values will now persist in Afghanistan. But I also see the United States as a strategic partner with India and the relationship having progressed in leaps and bounds, which makes it a very different picture from 20 years ago, right? When the United States was not an enemy, but neither was it a friend. I see the Quad as a way for India to have infrastructure and investments and communication lines open with three other countries that are really worried about China. But I also see AUKUS with mixed feelings. On one hand, it shifts responsibility from me to contain China in a meaningful way, given that China, as of this year, has overtaken the United States to become India's largest trading partner. But I also wonder why the United States doesn't share nuclear submarine technology with me, supposedly an ally.
Okay, just to be clear here, when you're using the first person, you're referring to Prime Minister Modi.
I'm referring, you asked me what India sees. The government doesn't see, but a person does.
Okay, fair enough.
So that's a very, very broad view.
Okay, I want to drill down into each of those bits, and there are a lot of bits there. But before we do that, Manjari, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about Indian strategic culture or sort of the weight of history on how India today sees its foreign policy. And I ask that because if you look at, let's say, China, I hear a lot about the century of humiliation, and that really shapes how Chinese leaders view the world. Likewise, if you look at the United States, you hear about sort of the missionary impulse in American foreign policy that sort of also oscillates with the isolationist impulse in American history. We both want to fix the world and be separated from the world. What kind of strategic culture does India have? And I ask that in the context, I think most people, certainly people of my age, when they think of India, think of a country that pioneered the non-aligned movement. The idea was not to get caught up in anyone else's camp. So maybe you can help us sort of think through that broader conception of sort of ideas or intuitions that shape Indian thinking?
Yeah. So Jim, you may not know this when you ask that question, but actually that's a can of worms, right? So the word strategic culture in India is very hotly debated because in 1992, George Tanam at Rand wrote a paper that Indian government officials still have not forgiven him for. And in it, he argued that India has no strategic culture. So rather than use the term strategic culture, I think what you're asking is India's worldview, right? Where does
its identity come from? I'll let you put the label on it you wish to put on it.
So if I were to look at India's worldview and identity and ideology, I do think, I mean, I wrote a book on this and how it is impacted by colonialism, right? So India, I argued, very much saw itself, I'm not going to say sees itself, but very much saw itself as a victim of colonialism and as a victim on the international stage, and often took positions that were quite puzzling for the United States. But if you look at, and you know, I think the non-aligned movement in a sense came out of that, the determination that India would not be dictated to by an imperialist power, by either imperialist powers, which it very much saw the Cold War as a competition between. But if I look at Indian worldview today, I mean, I'm with you. I think it's deeply puzzling because in India, nobody says non-alignment anymore, right? The word non-alignment, particularly with the BJP government, has become a dirty word because it comes from the Congress government.
BJP is the ruling name of the ruling party, majority
Correct.
Party.
Correct, the Bharatiya Janata Party, yes, the BJP that is in power today. And so non-alignment, they don't use the word non-alignment at all. But India does not have allies, right? It does not commit to security alliances. It's one of the reasons why it's very careful to talk about the United States as a partnership and not an alliance. If the Quad were a security alliance, it's doubtful India would be a part of it. So non-alignment in a way continues without ever having used the word non-alignment anymore. So what India's worldview is, I think, is very much in flux because you had the Congress Party, which was committed to secularism, which is committed to non-alignment, which is committed to, you know, India being on the international stage as a leader of these erstwhile colonized countries. But post-Cold War, I think India has been searching for that identity. And some of that has been filled by Hindu nationalism, which is very, you know, very strident view of what India's place in the world is, which is, you know, assertive to actually realize India's potential as a great power to be. But the nuts and bolts of it, right, are very missing because you can see it warring with previous ideas such as non-alignment. So does India need to step up and take fuller responsibility in the Quad? Well, you would think that that would align with Hindu nationalist views. But India is very, very wary of alliances. Where does that come from? That comes from the previous government and the previous worldview. So you can see these tensions that exist in India's worldview today. And it isn't really very clear, you know, how India thinks of itself as a rising power. I mean, in my book, I argue that it really lacks these narratives of great power. It has ideas about what it should do, but they're not ideas about great power per se.
Just one last question on things within India, Manjari, and that is, to what extent do these foreign policy issues that we talk about resonate with ordinary Indians? Is this something that can drive voting behavior, or are these debates mostly at an elite level? Most of the rest of Indian society has other issues that they're focused on.
Again, that's a multi-part question, right? So yes, they have salience depending on what the issue is, right? So one of the issues that has salience is anytime you talk about Pakistan, right? That has massive salience. You can beat anti-China drumbeats in India, and that would also have salience among the population, particularly among the youth who are deeply nationalistic, right? So with deep rising nationalism, you actually also have more of a response to issues like China and Pakistan. Quad, not so much, doesn't have salience. But at the same time, does that translate into voting behavior? That's been very difficult to show that it does, actually. And in fact, the BJP particularly is aware of this. And there's historical precedent. So let me explain what I mean. So the first time the BJP came to power under Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee, that is also the time that India went nuclear, right? So it conducted Operation
Shakti.
This is what,
back in the 1990s.
You've read, that's correct. Yes, back in the 1990s. So India undertakes Operation Shakti, declares nuclear weapons state status. Now, at that time, Vajpayee called elections based on a campaign that they called India Shining. And this idea was that India Shining, you know, showcasing India as this nuclear weapon state, you know, this prestige would actually resonate with voters. Turns out it didn't, right? The Indian voter was not interested in that. The Indian voter was interested in, you know, elections in India have been won and lost on the price of onions alone. And the BJP government was booted out. And so the BJP has learned a lesson from that. And so India Shining is something that has stuck in the mind of BJP politicians as well as government officials. And so in terms of voter issues, foreign policy is not something that politicians campaign on necessarily. They might allude to it, but that is not what's going to make or break elections.
Okay, so let's talk about specific issues, and let's begin with China, since it is in many ways India's main rival. I'm not sure that's the right word to use. You describe a relationship in which, on the one hand, deepening economic ties, China's emerged as India's leading leading trade partner. On the other hand, we have clashes in the Himalayas. So what is Prime Minister Modi's policy for dealing with China? And has it changed in recent months?
I think there is a slight disconnect here, I would argue, between the Indian military and the Indian foreign policy establishment, right? So on one hand, I will say that Prime Minister Modi has provided support for, you know, the Indian military building infrastructure along the border. That has been happening for a while. There has also been support for beefing up the Indian military to act as a deterrent to China. On the other, the Indian government has also been called conciliatory when it comes to China, right? And so both after Galwan and after, you know, Doklam Valley in 2017, Galwan was last year, there were steps taken immediately to de-escalate the situation. So it's really interesting because on one hand, what you're seeing here is this tension where China is absolutely a threat. And China, you know, there's a quote that I like to use. I use it in my writings because a very senior foreign policy official once said it to me. They said, well, you know, Pakistan is just the enemy. China is the adversary. So China is definitely the adversary. But at the same time, there's also a growing recognition that in China's case, there is an economic reality that cannot be wished away. And so therefore, you see a very careful posture, right? India would never be a part of the Quad if it was an explicitly anti-China alliance, right? It's very, very careful about that. And so that balancing act is something that the Indian government is trying to perfect while knowing that the Indian military absolutely sees China as its number one threat.
I will note, Manjari, that we see the United States government trying to strategically decouple from China in areas, particularly in high technology. Big question mark as to how effective that strategy is going to be. I wonder, do we see the Indian government trying to do something similar, that is, get the benefits of economic cooperation with China, but figure out what areas of the economy they want to have less China and more of either domestic production or transactions with other countries?
So I think particularly in the technology sector, right, India has been very wary of China. And recently, India decided to allow its mobile carriers to carry out 5G trials, right? But it didn't mention like Huawei. It's not going to allow ZTE, right? And so that's one way in which India has been trying to limit China's penetration of India's market. And so, yeah, so I mean, I think India is trying to focus on where it feels it can control Chinese inroads, particularly if they also relate to India's security.
Well, let's turn then and talk about the other great power, namely the United States and Indian relations with the United States. You mentioned, Manjari, that Prime Minister Modi is not looking for an alliance with the United States, but he does seemingly want to get closer. How then does Modi and how do Indians think about the Quad? What do they think it is? Because my sense in Washington is that they have great ambitions for the Quad and that a big part of the reason for the Quad is to provide a check on China.
Right. I think there's two things. I think one is that India does think of the Quad as extremely important strategically to contain China without ever uttering the words that it is anti-China.
Okay. So we don't use the word contain.
We don't use the word contain. Right. So yes, we don't use the word contain. We don't use the words anti-China.
But it's kind of like contain.
But it is containment.
Nudge.
Right. So what India is seeking is avenues of cooperation through the Quad that will effectively limit China's inroads into the region. But one of the issues is that India is much more interested.
Just on that quickly, Manjari, sorry to interrupt. When you say the region, how does India define the region? What are the borders?
That's exactly what I was getting to, which is, I think, really interesting because India defines the region differently from the United States, right? So for India, India is much more interested in the Indian Ocean region than in the Pacific. So when India sees the region, when India sees the Indo-Pacific framework, right, India sees that as essentially stretching from the east coast of Africa, including portions of the Middle East, to the Western and Southern Pacific. However, in contrast, the United States doesn't include either Africa or the Middle East, right, in its conception of the Indo-Pacific. So there itself, you can kind of see a difference between how India thinks about the Quad and how the rest of the Quad members think about it. But on the other hand, you know, there, especially with the recent summit, there were certain initiatives taken that are very, very important to India, like vaccine diplomacy, right? So cooperation on vaccines is hugely important to India. This is something that India had, you know, Prime Minister Modi had initiated before the second wave of COVID hit. It was one of the things that his government was blamed for, right? Because they focused on exporting vaccines, leaving, you know, very few for the Indian population. So I think countering China through vaccines, cooperation on climate change, these are all important to India because they are, I don't want to call them baby steps, but there are steps towards cementing relationships within a multilateral framework that also have the effect of excluding China, right, without ever coming out and saying so. So the Quad is really important to China. I should also point out that this is not one way, right? So India is very important to the Quad as well. I mean, if you have the Quad be Australia, Japan, and the United States, essentially you're leaving out the Indian Ocean region. And so India is as important to the Quad as the Quad is to it. But I think it'll be interesting to see in what way the Quad develops, right? And what kind of commitment India puts into it if it's not going to be a security alliance, right? And I think that's the challenge. And here we're, of course, getting to a slight tension between how the United States thinks of containing China, which is in terms of security, and what China has been doing, which is really more in terms of long-term economic strategy. So can the Quad counter that? And that's going to be interesting to see.
I want to dive a little bit more into U.S.-Indian relations. But before we do that, Manjari, I'd like to talk about a country in an organization we haven't mentioned yet. The country is Russia. The organization is the EU. Obviously, India for many years had very good relations with Russia and its predecessor, the Soviet Union, even if it was officially non-aligned. Meanwhile, obviously, you mentioned colonialism being a big factor shaping Indian thinking. That brings to mind, you know, Great Britain, the imperial power. I realize that Great Britain has left the European Union, but how should we think about India's relations with the EU or even with Britain?
India's relationship with Great Britain, I think, is now quite interesting because I think the UK thinks of India as more necessary to it than India thinks of the UK, right? So there's been a reversal of roles in that sense. With respect to the EU, India has been intent on developing its relationships with the EU. It has an excellent relationship with France. So, for example, with AUKUS, India was very empathetic to France's dismay at being left out of the deal.
Yeah, I should just say for people who aren't familiar with the acronym, this is the Australia, United Kingdom, United States agreement, that part of which includes the United States providing advanced nuclear submarine technology, not nuclear weapons, but nuclear submarine technology to the Australians.
Essentially, India and the EU has an extremely close, has a closer trade relationship than in the past. The EU is India's third largest trading partner. They are both aware of China's inroads. And so they both would like to have a bilateral free trade deal. I think they're trying to begin negotiations on that that would exclude China. But at the same time, like when I talk with European officials, there's a sense of bewilderment when it comes to India and dealing with India that they don't quite know how to grasp Indian foreign policy or India's goals in the world. And this really very much comes back to the worldview that you were talking about before, Jim. And so they understand where China is coming from. They might not agree with China, but they understand where China is coming from. And they really often don't know where India is coming from.
And what about Russia?
So Russia-India relations have always been very good, right, for a very long time. And that's not likely to change in the near future. India-Russia relations have, you know, go back to the Cold War when India was non-aligned, but it leaned towards the Soviet Union. And so, you know, that relationship continued even after the fall of the Soviet Union. So India's military hardware is still Russia dependent, right? And so even though the United States would like India to, is sometimes frustrated with the pace of India's weapons procurement from the United States, the fact is it's very difficult. It's been very difficult for India to reduce its reliance on Russia. You know, that's what the S-400 deal, for example, you know, showed.
This being a missile.
That's correct. Right.
Delivery
yes.
system.
Which the United States was not happy about at all. And so that relationship has continued. And, you know, that Russia is very sympathetic to India's concerns. They're very empathetic as well. It's not just that it's a security relationship. It's not just that India has always procured its hardware from Russia. It's also the fact that there is a sense of diplomatic support that exists with Russia that's existed for a very long time that India has been very reluctant to turn away from.
I want to go back now to the issue of the evolving U.S.-Indian relationship, given that we've sort of laid down the context for things. And my takeaway from this conversation is that the United States would like to have a closer relationship with India, both bilaterally and through devices like the Quad. India would also like to have closer relations with the United States, both bilaterally and through things like the Quad. But the fact that their interests and ambitions align on some issues doesn't mean they overlap entirely. And indeed, when I look at proposals for the United States to develop its relations with India, what I see is a lot of potential irritants and limitations in the relationship. I mean, we have issues like human rights, which have divided the two, and a subchapter that may be Kashmir, which you talked about briefly before. But you also have real irritants over trade issues. And potentially, certainly from the Indian point of view, real concerns about America's staying power. You mentioned that Delhi wasn't crazy about the withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan, and certainly didn't like the way the withdrawal took place. So how should we think about how U.S.-Indian relations may develop given all these potential irritants or speed bumps or obstacles to getting to what both sides hope is a better, deeper relationship?
I want to be careful in how I state this. So yes, there are definitely irritants in the relationship, right? I think the United States' frustration with India sometimes is palpable. I do think that India absolutely resents any kind of comments on human rights, particularly in Kashmir. It would absolutely resent any kind of comment on the current government's policies or about erosion of democracy in India that many have claimed is happening in both academia as well as in, you know, public life. And so that would definitely mar the relationship. At the same time, I don't think we should underestimate how fast this relationship has progressed. I mean, if I were to look at the history of India-US relations, the United States has been talking about India as a counterbalancer to China for decades, right? Decades. And every couple of years, there would be an article on the new and deep partnership. So, you know, that pivot just was touched upon over and over and over again, but never really happened. But in the last few years, you know, since the Trump administration, what you have had is really a pickup in the pace of the relationship that hadn't happened before, right? You had a number of security agreements signed. You had essentially India warm up to the idea of very, very close cooperation, open cooperation with the United States in a way that you hadn't seen before. And part of it was because of Doklam and the Galwan Valley clash. So, you know, I don't think we should underestimate that either. So yes, it's true that there are irritants in the relationship, but it is also true that over the past 4 or 5 years, the relationship has changed. Like, there's almost no observer of Indian foreign policy who would tell you today that the relationship is not a very different relationship from what it was during even the Obama administration.
Okay, so you're saying then, just sort of given the current context, the relationship really has a wind at its back?
I think it does, yes. I think it does. I mean, it also depends on if the United States makes statements on Indian domestic politics, right? So I would say that, you know, any statements on Indian domestic politics would not be welcome at all. There are factors that matter, and that could definitely, I wouldn't put a dent in the relationship, but maybe stall the relationship a little. But I think at this point, the relationship has deepened so much. It's such a consequential one. And it's so important to both countries that I don't think that there is any way to stymie it.
So I take it then that you don't see Afghanistan as a major breaking point in development and relations. And I ask that because, you know, when the withdrawal was taking place, there were a lot of people showing up on cable news stations and writing op-eds saying the United States had destroyed its credibility. Nobody will want to work with the United States. They're going to run away because we can't be trusted because we tend to pick up our stakes and go home. But it doesn't sound like that's what's happening in terms of the U.S. relations, and it certainly doesn't seem to be the conclusion that the Indian government has drawn.
No, and I think the sense that I got actually from Indian government officials was that they felt that the United States had been very transparent with India about its withdrawal. So they were informed well in advance that the United States was intending to withdraw. The Indian government started shutting down its operations in Afghanistan back in May. So I certainly have not felt that sense of betrayal. When I talked to Indian government officials, it was almost seen as inevitable that it was going to happen and that they felt that they had been fully informed at every step. What's interesting is this credibility issue that you mentioned. The only place I really saw that, and that was only not from government officials either, that was really more from the military angle, was I saw writings on how AUKUS and the decision to cut France, which was a NATO ally, out of the deal, gave India pause. Because what does that mean? That the United States will not, you know, never shares its sensitive technology except with Australia. And what does it mean that it would cut France out, which is a NATO ally? So what hope does India stand, which is not an ally, which has just is a partner? So that's where I saw more of concern than when it came to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. But at the same time, I will say that there is a strong perception in India that holds across the board about U.S. decline, which is, you know, which is interesting because they do see the U.S. as declining. That's said quite openly, and they do see the next century as you know, the rise of China. And that's a different calculation.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Manjari. It thinks the United States is a declining rather than a steady or rising power. Is it simply because there's no alternative?
I think so, yes. I think it's because China is not an alternative. So the United States is the best bet. And the United States is very keen to have a great relationship with India.
So somebody is better than nobody at all.
Somebody is better than nobody at all. It's not going to be Russia. It's definitely not China. So yeah. I think so.
So I take your point, Manjari, looking forward, that the Biden administration, which is hoping to deepen the relationship with India, should, if it wants to avoid creating tensions with India, avoid criticizing India on issues like the erosion of democracy or handling in Kashmir. That may be a big challenge for the Biden administration, because we also have Congress, which is a separate branch of government, which can take positions on these issues and demand action by the administration. But putting that aside, what are the issues or steps you think the Biden administration should be taking proactively in service of its desire to deepen relations with India?
If I were to be brutally honest, and if you read accounts of India-US relations over the last 10, 15 years, I would say that the incentives to deepen the partnership, right, the concessions have really, a lot of it has come from the United States. And so I'm trying to think of what else the Biden administration could do to deepen the partnership. And I think and not just the Biden administration, I think the United States administration for the last 4 or 5 years has been trying to take those steps, and even in the past did take those steps. I mean, think about the 1-2-3 agreement, you know, with India, which was a landmark nuclear deal. The United States has never done that for any other country. I mean, it supports India's entry into the nuclear suppliers group. It supports India's bid for a permanent seat in the United Nations Security Council. So I think those are all steps that the United States government has taken to deepen the partnership. Would the Indian government like more? Yes. They would like sharing of sensitive technology. They would have loved a nuclear submarine technology that the United States just shared with Australia. But I do think that the US administration has invested a lot in this relationship and is going to continue to invest in this relationship, because this has realized that this area is of such strategic importance. One of the things that we haven't talked about that exists, and actually not much data exists on it simply because, you know, it's classified, is how much intelligence sharing there is. There's a lot of intelligence sharing between the United States and India already. So this relationship, I mean, I don't know if I would say it's on an upward trajectory, but it's on a very steady trajectory at this point. I think there what could happen is there could be things that are pinpricks in the relationship that'd be best to avoid. But I don't think at this point there is any way to derail it, barring, you know, a tone-deaf policy by the United States.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Manjari Chatterjee Miller, CFR Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia. Manjari, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.